Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Ecclesiastes chapter 6, which I will entitle Riches Are Meaningless, Continued. Solomon finished off the last chapter talking about how vain and futile and meaningless riches are, and he continues with the theme here in chapter 6. So we start now in Ecclesiastes 6, verses 1 through 2. Solomon begins, "Here is a tragedy I have observed under the sun, and it weighs heavily on humanity. God gives a man riches, wealth, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all he desires for himself, but God does not allow him to enjoy them. Instead, a stranger will enjoy them. This is futile and a sickening tragedy. Now, this wealthy man is a man who is wealthy because of God's grace, not because of oppression." Solomon dealt in the last chapter with riches that were gained in an ill-gotten fashion. Ecclesiastes 5:8 says, "If you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight, for one official watches over another official, and there are higher officials over them, watching over themselves to protect themselves from investigation." So there's oppression and injustice. And two verses later, in Ecclesiastes 5:10, Solomon says, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money." The implication, of course, is that it's corrupt officials who are making the money. So in verse 10, Ecclesiastes 5, he says, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. This too is vanity." But now, in this chapter, chapter 6, it's not money obtained by hook and crook. It's money obtained by God's favor. Verse 2, "God gives a man riches, wealth, and honor." Now, during Solomon's time, as a matter of fact, there were a lot of rich people because Solomon himself was rich, but not only Solomon, but the whole country. Silver was said to be as common as stones in Jerusalem, 1 Kings 10, verse 27. "The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and he made cedar as abundant as sycamore in the Judean foothills." Cedar, of course, is a very valuable tree. Sycamores are very common. But there were cedar trees everywhere. There was silver everywhere. God did that. God gave Solomon and the kingdom of Israel all those riches, and he gave Solomon wealth and honor to boot. That's the good news. But at the end of verse 2, this tragedy which Solomon has observed under the sun in this life is described by the fact that God does not allow the rich man to enjoy all those things. Now, Ecclesiastes 5:19, in the last chapter, Solomon has described a man whom God has allowed to enjoy wealth. He says in Ecclesiastes 5:19, "God has also given riches and wealth to every man, and he has allowed him to enjoy them. Take his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is a gift of God." And of course, in that chapter, Solomon is saying there's nothing wrong with working and enjoying money. But the problem is a lot of rich people can't enjoy their money. They work and they work and they work and they pile up money, and instead somebody else gets to enjoy the money instead of them. A stranger, Solomon calls them in verse 2. Well, how are ways that a stranger might get a man's wealth? Well, the rich man could go bankrupt. The stranger could defraud the rich man or steal from the rich man. The rich man could have heirs who squander an inheritance. The rich man could make foolish investments and the investments could go bad. Lots of ways wealth can end up where the wealthy man did not intend for the wealth to end up. And Solomon finishes up by describing the situation as a futile and sickening tragedy. That's the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. It's a good translation. Futile and sickening. It is sickening to see somebody lose all his wealth, but it happens all the time. We go now to Ecclesiastes 6, verses 3 through 6. Solomon continues, "A man may father 100 children and live many years. No matter how long he lives, if he is not satisfied by good things and does not even have a proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For he comes in futility," the stillborn child does, "comes in futility, and he goes in darkness, and his name is shrouded in darkness. Though a stillborn child does not see the sun and is not conscious, it has more rest than he. And if he lives 1,000 years twice, but does not experience happiness, do not both go to the same place, i.e. the grave?" If he lives 1,000 years twice, in other words, if he lives 2,000 years. So in verse 3, this man, he's got 100 children. Back then in the ancient world, of course, having children was a good thing, and 100 children is a very good thing to me. I can't imagine such a thing. This is speaking hyperbolically, of course. And if he lives many years, in verse 6, he gives a number on that expression, many years, 2,000 years. Of course, this is speaking, again, in a very exaggerated fashion. No matter how many children he has, no matter how long he has, if he's not satisfied by good things, why? Because he's always looking for more wealth. Wealth is a good thing, but if you're not satisfied by that good thing, you start looking for more. A wife is a good thing, but if you start looking for more wives, well, we'll see how that worked out for Solomon. Same thing with money. If you have money and the money buys you good things, but you got to have more of it, well, you're not satisfied with what you got. And in fact, this rich man could even end up in a situation where he does not have a proper burial. Now, how could that happen? John Gill gives some examples here. As Jezebel, Jehoiakim, and others, who was either destroyed by robbers and cutthroats for the sake of his substance and cast into a ditch or a river, or some place where he is never found to be interred, or else, being of such a sordid disposition, he provides not for a decent burial suitable to his circumstances, or forbids one, or being despised and disesteemed by all men, his heirs and successors either neglect or refuse to give him one. Now, in the East, to be without a proper burial is the greatest degradation, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. So, what good does it do if you're rich all your life and then your heirs and your contemporaries despise you so bad they won't even go to your funeral because you were such a jerk during your lifetime? Or sometimes it happens, especially with military leaders, they get killed on the battlefield and their bodies are lost. So Solomon says a stillborn child is better off than such a man who is wealthy and dies without a proper burial, because that stillborn child doesn't get to see all the misery that the rich man's going to see because he never sees the light of day. His name is shrouded in darkness. How many stillborn children do you know enough to know their names? I know a friend of mine had a stillborn child, a miscarriage. They buried the child. They had a service over the child. It was very emotional, sad. Especially for the mother, and they named that baby. But nobody knows about that baby except them. That's pretty bad, but it's not as bad as the rich man who is not satisfied because of his voracious, sensuous appetite. The unhappy rich man, verse 6, if he lives 2,000 years but does not experience happiness and goes to the same place as that stillborn child, the grave. We go now to Ecclesiastes 6, verses 7 through 9. Solomon continues, all man's labor is for his stomach, yet the appetite is never satisfied. What advantage then does the wise man have over the fool? What advantage is there for the poor person who knows how to conduct himself before others? Better what the eye see than wandering desire. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind. Now these verses have a problematic section in them, which I will look at in just a minute. But first of all, in verse 7, all man's labor is for his stomach. The stomach is a synecdoche for all the wants of life. A synecdoche is something that's mentioned as a part, which is supposed to represent the whole. Well, the stomach represents the whole person who is lusting after things he can't have, whose appetite is never satisfied because he wants things such as sex, money, power, and fame. He's never satisfied because he wants more of it once he gets it. There is nothing worse than this, and there's a lot of people caught up into that. In verse 8, Solomon says, what advantage then does the wise man have over the fool? In other words, the fool is lusting for sensuous things he can't ever have. The wise man is not doing that, but the wise man is going to die just like the fool. So Solomon, in his cynical mood, is saying, well, so what good does it do to be wise like me? I'm going to die just like the sensuous fool is. The pulpit commentary says the wise man gets no more enjoyment out of sensuality than does the fool. A wise man can only eat one meal at a time, just like the fool. The Cambridge commentary says, in this matter, the gifts of intellect make no difference. The wise, no less than the fool, is subject to the pressure of bodily necessities and has to labor for them. So, in the long run, the wise man is going to die just like the fool is. And if you think about the book of Ecclesiastes, what Solomon is saying is people are going to die. And that's what really bothers him, because all the work, all the good stuff, he admits a lot of it is good, but it's not going to last because people are going to die. He's looking at the problem of death is what he's really looking at. All right, so the wise man has no advantage over the fool because the wise man has to die too. But then the last part of verse 8, this is the problematic portion I was talking about. In the Holman Christian Study Bible translation, and in fact most of my translations, all of my translations translated this way, what advantage is there for the poor person who knows how to conduct himself before others? What does that mean? Well, let's look at three options. Here's option number one. A wise, poor person still has to eat just like the sensuous fool. So, verse 8b would be read this way. What advantage is there for the poor person who is also a wise person because he knows how to conduct himself before others? What advantage does this person have over the sensuous fool? He has no advantage because he's going to die, just like the sensuous fool's going to die. Well, there's a little problem with that is, why would you mention a poor person? Why would you think that there's an advantage for the poor person? Usually poor people don't seem to have advantages. Well, let's go to the second possible interpretation. The Cambridge Commentary suggests this option. Suggest a translation that is different than the Holman Christian Study Bible translation that I just gave you. The Cambridge translation is, what advantage hath the poor over him who knows how to walk before the living? Now, the one who knows how to walk before the living in the Cambridge translation is the rich man, the high-born man, the noble man. He's going to die. But then the question is why would you say that a poor person would have an advantage? Why would you even think that? What advantage is there for the poor person? Well, the idea here is that poverty is not an escape from the worries of the rich, as the Cambridge commentator says. In other words, poor people don't have to worry about bankruptcy, bad investments, people stealing your money, people trying to harangue you for money all the time, beg you for money, and all the problems that go with being rich. Poor person doesn't have to worry about that. But he still doesn't have an advantage because he's got to die just like the rich man. Well, you could take it that way. A third possible way to interpret the last part of verse 8 is this, by translating that phrase as an indicative rather than interrogative. So the translation would be, what an advantage the poor man has who knows how to conduct himself before others over the sensuous fool. He has an advantage because he is not a slave to his appetite, as the rich sensuous fool is a slave to his appetite. Well, of all those three options, I like option A the best, which goes along with all the translations. What advantage is there for the poor person who knows how to conduct himself before others? In other words, this is a wise poor person. He knows how to deal with other people. He knows how to conduct himself. He's righteous. He's poor, but he's righteous. But he still doesn't have an advantage over the rich sensuous fool because he's going to die like the rich sensuous fool is going to die. That fits with the first part of verse 8, which says, what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? So you have a good wise man has no advantage over the fool because the wise man is going to die just like the sensuous fool. And in the second part of the verse, you have an upright poor person relieved from the burdens of wealth. He's upright, but he has no advantage. Even though he is relieved from the burdens of wealth, he has no advantage because he's going to die too, just like the rich sensuous fool. In verse 9, Solomon says, better what the eyes see than wandering desire. In other words, the things that you have that, you should be content with what you have, with what you see, rather than conjuring up in your mind something that you could have but that you don't have. That's basically the definition of lust, and lust will kill you dead spiritually and socially and physically. It'll just kill you. Lust is a terrible thing. Solomon finishes verse 9 by saying this too is futile in a pursuit of the wind. What's futile, and what is a pursuit of the wind? Lusting after things that you don't see and can't have, and letting your desires wander from one foolish vain thing to another. We go now to Ecclesiastes 6, verses 10 through 12, and we will finish this chapter. Solomon continues, whatever exists was given its name long ago, and it is known what man is, but he is not able to contend with the one stronger than he. For when there are many words, they increase futility. What is the advantage for man? For who knows what is good for man in life in the few days of his futile life that he spends like a shadow? Who can tell man what will happen after him under the sun? Now, verse 10 is very strange. At first blush, whatever exists was given its name long ago. This is referring to Adam. He was given his name by God. Adam means man, mankind. Whatever exists was given its name long ago. And it is known what man is, what mankind is. A bunch of wretched sinners, because Adam and his descendants were afflicted with sin, and more sin. So it's known, everybody knows that man is a sinner, but he, man, is not able to contend with the one. That's a capital O in the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. But man is not able to contend with the one God stronger than he. In other words, man can't look at God and say, I'm not a sinner, I'm okay, I don't need you. Now, this verse 10, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, is the beginning of part 2 of the book of Ecclesiastes, for all you literary critic types out there. And as those commentators say, the answer to all the futility that Solomon has mentioned in part one of the book, the answers are coming now in part two of the book. In verse 11, Solomon says, "For when there are many words, they increase futility." Now we have a translation issue here. The Hebrew noun for words can either be translated as things or words. So the verse could read, "For when there are many things, they increase futility." Well, that translation makes it easy. Examples have already been given all throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. When there are many things, such as wealth, pleasure, power, the affairs of life, they increase futility. That's a straightforward explanation. If the translation is words, "For when there are many words, they increase futility," the words would then mean speculative discussions about life. As the Cambridge commentator says, if you translate it as words, the words probably refer to the speculative discussions on the chief good, destiny, and the like, which were rife in the schools both of Jews and Greeks. The pulpit commentator says that the words were expressions of impatience, doubt, and unbelief to which men give utterance when arraigning the acts or endeavoring to explain the decrees of God. So the pulpit commentator has it with the words a little bit negative towards God. So either philosophical discussions or complaints to God, that's all futile. Whatever Solomon meant here, or if he meant things, all the things he's talked about are futile. What is the advantage for man? There is no advantage for man. If he has things or many words or all the philosophy in the world, why? Verse 12, "For he knows what is good for man." For who knows? In verse 12, "For who knows what is good for man in life, in the few days of his futile life that he spends like a shadow." It's real hard to know what you should do and when you should do it. Life is hard. And at the end of verse 12, "Who can tell man what will happen after him under the sun?" A man makes decisions all his life on what he should do, but does he know what's going to happen to his kids or his grandchildren? No. I know that as America is swirling down the toilet hole over the last decade, as the anti-Christians have taken over the culture and the government, you'll hear a lot of people saying, "Well, this is horrible. We need to stop this because of our grandkids." And I remember thinking to myself, I don't think that I'm going to be worried about my grandkids while I'm in heaven. Then Christmas comes, the grandkids come, and I start thinking about it. Yeah, well, maybe I'm a little bit worried about it. But let's face it, you die, you're not going to be worried about your grandkids, no matter what happens in this life. Who can tell man what will happen after him under the sun? Why? Because you aren't under the sun anymore when you're in the grave, and you don't know what's going on down here. Back at the first part of verse 12, Solomon says, "Who knows what is good for man in life?" I've already mentioned that men don't know what's good after they die when they're in the grave, but even while they're living, it's hard to know what's good. Often, that which seems to be good is only that which satisfies vanity, and it turns out to be meaningless and striving after the wind. And so Solomon is basically saying, since it's impossible to know what is good, it's best to be content with what we have. Because often what we think is good turns out to be evil. Think of that country song years ago. "Oh, that's good. No, that's bad. No, that's good. No, that's bad." Hard to know. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished with chapter 6 of Ecclesiastes, the Book of Wisdom, written by Solomon. And we are now prepared to go to chapter 7 in our next audio, which I will entitle The Contrast of Wisdom and Folly. I hope you stay with me for that exposition, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.